Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This week's episode of Screen Talk is sponsored by HBO, presenting Mare of Easttown, nominated for 16 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited or Anthology Series, and Outstanding Lead Actress in a Limited or Anthology Series or Movie for Kate Winslet. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large, and we've got plenty of stuff to discuss this week, and it's fascinating because at this particular point in time, it kind of feels like a pre-2020 sort of season in the sense that we've got some award season hype with festival stuff coming out. We've got little tidbits of award season announcements that are going to inform the months ahead. So it's kind of, I don't want to say comforting, but it feels a little normal-ish in the way that a pre-2020 kind of looks like. I know that's not going to stay the same indefinitely, but how are you feeling about, let's say, the Toronto announcements? Looking pretty good, right?
Yeah, they've got a robust lineup. I mean, a lot of questions are being asked, or as we discussed last week, a little bit about how, you know, what talent is going to go. Jessica Chastain is going to go because she's
somehow
got a tribute, an award tribute for. And I've been hearing a lot of buzz about The Eyes of Tammy Faye as a kind of definitely an actress makeup slash costume hair and makeup performance, sort of like Charlize Theron, playing Megan. What was her name? The newscaster that she played in Bombshell?
The
Fox News lady?
Megan, obviously. Megan Kelly. Yeah.
Kelly. Megan Kelly.
I know she's easy to forget when she's not on TV every night.
Yeah, I don't think about her very much at all. So the point being that Jessica Chastain transforms herself and is getting an award at TIFF, and they've done well with those TIFF award tributes in the past.
They wouldn't give her the award if there wasn't real investment.
Yeah. So Searchlight is going to push that, you know, pretty hard, and it's going to be a world premiere at Toronto. There had been rumors that it might be at Telluride, but it's going to be an awards thing at Toronto.
And you
Toronto
gotta be also careful about those Telluride rumors.
I know. Toronto. No, you can tell. All you have to do is look at what's a Canadian premiere, or you know, whatever
international.
So speaking of which, there's a list of documentaries that came out from TIFF, and there's some good Oscar possibilities there. The Cousteau, Becoming Cousteau from Liz Garbus, which is Nat Geo.
Good old Jacques Cousteau finally getting his tribute.
So they get to dig into the archives and have some fun on the Calypso with all the merry band of revelers on the open sea. And then you have another set of divers, as it were, in the rescue, which is from the people who brought you Free Solo.
Yeah, Chai Versailles and Jimmy Chin. And I can't wait for that one.
That looks really good. Fun.
Almost, I mean, the thing I loved about Free Solo was that it kind of crossed into this, that other realm where even though it's not like reinventing the traditional rules of documentary storytelling, it's using them to create an experience that feels like it's more of a different kind of story and more different kind of cinema. Like that was, it's like an action thriller sort of experience in documentary terms, and the footage is just so extraordinary. Obviously the Thai cave rescue, I mean, that was one of the great real-time thriller survivor stories.
Sort of like Ace in the Hole or something, but the trick here is that the divers had footage of their own that they shot, and I actually saw a clip of the actual moment of discovery when the diver worrying and expecting the worst, and they had to go underwater through all of these tunnels and caves and crevasses, and they finally find the team sitting there, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah,
so Nat Geo is pushing those two.
Yeah. And the thing I'm really excited about with those is that it feels to me like these are movies that are going to be very theatrically oriented. I mean, especially The Rescue, which is, you know, was almost like, I mean, the Free Solo was like an IMAX movie. I mean, really benefited from when it had the IMAX treatment. And so I feel like it's going to be fascinating to see how festivals can be a platform for these films, because obviously something like that's going to need that kind of first time for the world to start talking about it, irrespective of how it launches. So,
well, I think it's going to be at a couple of different film festivals, both of those. And then there's also the opening nighter, which is Attica, which is from Stanley Nelson, veteran filmmaker, Emmy winner, going into what happened there at the prison. And there's a related, interestingly, a related movie where Hold Your Fire, which is about the longest siege ever, sort of like Dog Day Afternoon. Remember Attica from Dog Day Afternoon. So there's some films for sale as well. And then Penny Lane comes back with Listening to Kenny G, which is all about how you can have a saxophonist like him who is equally revered and dismissed.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
I might be in the latter category.
I mean, the very idea that, I mean, it's like the fact that Kenny G for a lot of people feels like a punchline, like a cultural joke,
right?
He's like, opens up a lot of fascinating angles, and she's such a dynamic filmmaker. I mean,
she's gonna have
like
fun
Nuts
with it,
or Hail Satan. It's like she can make, I mean, it goes back to the point I was making. It's like she's not reinventing the rules of documentary storytelling, but she's bringing something to, even that there's a certain like bottom line audience member who's like, oh, I don't like documentaries as a category or something, but there's an entertainment value baked into her films that I think it wins over even those people in the best possible situation. So I was excited for that. And also this film Biba, which
that looks good. Beautiful. That's a first time filmmaker. And there's two films that are for sale from first time filmmakers who are talking about their families. Biba is one of them and Kamala is the other. And we talked to Tom Powers, who sort of explained that both of them, these young 30-ish filmmakers, are trying to come to terms with how to break out of the legacy of dysfunctional families. So that they both sound really cool.
And of course, Flea is there, making its way back to the festival scene after being a big hit at Sundance back in January. And that's when Neon picked it up and it won the festival there. And so I think it's going to be cool to have that one kind of reintroduced, because so much time has elapsed. So this is one where it's almost like they're going to build in new audiences. We were sort of part of that.
That's definitely going to, there's going to be a few Sundance movies that are going to have to make a comeback in the award season. The front runners right now in the documentary race are Flea, which everyone will catch up with if they haven't already. And Neon will do a big push for it. And then the other one is Summer of Soul, which broke at Sundance, playing in Toronto, but that's in the race as well.
That's one that's already on Hulu and stuff too. So it's very accessible and easy for to kind of continue to have around in that sense. And they certainly did a big marketing push for it, so it made a big impact. But it sounds like a lot of these films could end up sort of complicating that conversation. So it'll be fascinating.
Well, there isn't that much of a conversation yet. In a way, this is, I mean, we saw Velvet Underground in Cannes or Val. Val, which is opening soon, are both maybe in the conversation as well. We'll see.
Yeah. And there were some other sections at TIFF that hold promise. I thought it was pretty cool, actually, that the Midnight section, which is certainly smaller than it normally is opening with the Palme d'Or winning film, Titane.
Of course it is.
I mean, it's a great midnight movie, but Cannes didn't put it in its midnight section. You know, that is a competition.
They had the sense to recognize that it needed to be in competition. I'm glad they did.
Yeah, but I do love when films like that, like genre filmmaking, can travel to different kinds of places and have different identities. Like I remember when Lars von Trier's Antichrist was at Cannes, it was like so controversial and divisive and all this stuff. And then it went to like Fantastic Fest and all these genre festivals, and they just like embraced it. And I feel like the genre crowd, I mean, this is a film that, you know, understands the nature of genre storytelling as a platform for exploring complicated ideas about identity and society and so forth. And I think it's going to be really fun to see it kind of enter into that world, which will then again lift it up to a bigger conversation, hopefully for American audiences as well. Now, is it an Oscar contender? You're not totally as convinced as I am, but I feel like there could be some real conversations there if it continues to play anywhere near as well as it did.
You know, the fact that, you know, a movie like Promising Young Woman did as well as it did, you know, there's room for
the logic
for
is
the new membership to be a little more forgiving and international than the old.
Yeah. And how cool is it also that we'll have the first woman director to win the Palme, Jane Campion, and the second Julia DeCorno, both kind of making the rounds this fall. I feel like there's
that's cool.
Lot of,
yeah, and Power of the Dog could be a really big major. It's hitting every festival, but virtually.
It certainly is. And we also got the New York Film Festival closing night, which is opening Venice, and that's Pedro Almodovar's film Parallel Mothers. So
that looks like a strong candidate as well. I cannot
really
wait to see that one. It should be the Spanish submission for sure.
One always hopes. I mean, I would say like with people like that, it's like you can't discount Pedro. I mean, this guy in the middle of the pandemic went and made his first English language film, a short film. And then comes back and makes this ambitious thing with Penelope
Cruz. I think
Cruz.
That's on Mubi now. If everyone hasn't seen it yet, they should look at it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Snubbed by the Academy too last year. That was a real bummer. So, what else in terms of recent announcements? We've got a lot of other things to dig through here. So on the,
well, there's
on
some
the,
debate about going to CinemaCon in Las Vegas.
Yes.
There's some questions about that. The studios are supporting the exhibitors. The exhibitors are insisting on having their annual convention, having missed it last year, as they try to mount a comeback as a business that's just being completely destroyed, not completely, but impacted by COVID. And they really want to make a strong stand, and the studios sort of have to go along with them, even if they're reluctant to put their talent at risk. So I'm curious to see how that plays out in a place that's riddled with COVID.
Yeah, it's not the most attractive place to tell any kind of comeback story right now, to be honest with you. So,
well, they say they're going to all demand, you know, that everybody wear a wristband and go into the casinos. You know, they can't go to any events without the wristband that shows that they've vaccinated, and they have to wear masks and everything. But you're still inside those casinos. What can you do?
Yeah, it's not like, I mean, I said before, I weirdly felt safer at Cannes than I might have in other kinds of places because of all the precautions in place. I don't know if I really was safer, but
it felt
some
safe.
Of it, it's a feeling thing first, I
sure.
think.
Sure, I never felt like I was in a risky situation.
Right.
Again. But
and
then
I
again, the
there.
Delta variant wasn't. Yeah. There, so
well, we didn't see it. It probably
at least
was
it wasn't
there.
as reported there. And I'm in LA where the Delta variant is running wild. So
right. Well, I was thinking about this also with respect to some recent box office reporting. I mean, you look at everyone talking about Jungle Cruise did what 30 something million in box office, 30 something million on Disney Plus, and everyone's saying, well, not only was it because of day and date, but the Delta variant is scaring people off from going to the movies again. And I'm curious to know how a conversation like this could unfold at CinemaCon in whatever form it takes. Because
that's
now
why
this
I wanted
is
to go. I really wanted
that's
to go and be course. There on the ground and talk to people and get there, you know, get them to talk about what's really going to happen with their industry. Would I discover that they're all, you know, kind of
in denial,
myopically not seeing the real picture? That's possible. It's likely,
but you know,
it would have been interesting.
What it just like I always feel like I hammer this home when these conversations come up is that if Jungle Cruise was an exciting enough movie to go see, it wouldn't, the day and date part of the conversation and the question of is movie going dropping off again because of Delta fears, I don't know if it would have been as prominent, because like I haven't seen the movie. But like, is anybody really talking about Jungle Cruise as a must-see movie
right
now?
It got pretty bad reviews.
It got
actually.
Really bad reviews. And
so
I
didn't go. I was supposed to go see it, and I'd heard it wasn't
and
that
you could
good,
watch
so
it
I didn't
at
make
home,
the
too.
Effort. Here's
you
the thing.
You didn't even make the effort to rent it on Disney Plus.
No, I wouldn't do that. I mean, anyway, if I were going to go somewhere, I would see it in a movie theater. And you know what's happened is for me to schlep up to Hollywood Boulevard.
Got to be worth
you know,
it.
It's got to be worth it. Exactly right.
Case.
So I don't mind going. I go to screenings all the time. I'm going over to the Rodeo Drive or the Wilshire or whatever. Those are easy. But for me to schlep all the way to Hollywood or Burbank or someplace, it better be good.
Well, but I think even though we are not the ideal case studies because we are journalists
spoiled.
And we're people, yeah, we're spoiled and we're privileged and all that stuff. I do think that if it's hard for you to see it, it's, you know, all the more so unlikely for a lot of other people to be all that.
They're not going
to
schlep either unless they have a reason to believe it's really good. And F9, they thought would deliver the goods. And that's the biggest hit so far.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I finally caught up with on
I still haven't seen it. I have no interest.
Wasn't my favorite of the franchise.
None.
Charlize Theron spends most of the movie in a glass box with no bathroom, so I didn't totally understand the logic of it, but it was very amusing.
I'm sure she was equipped.
She had a good time. She has a very strange monologue about Luke Skywalker. There's a lot. Obviously, they go to space. Everyone knows that. The problem I have with these movies is that they, no matter how ridiculous they get, they all start to feel sort of like the same thing. Like you could cross-cut the last three of them and make a new Fast movie, which is maybe kind of a contemporary idea, but that's the issue I have. I mean, yes, people went to see it and they had a good time. And I think the difference between that and say a Jungle Cruise type of movie, which again, we haven't seen, is that the Fast movies, like they know what they need to deliver, and they deliver that really specific thing. I think a lot of these other temples we see, it's like they're not exactly sure who they're supposed to appeal to, and it just gets lost.
We're going to get to Suicide Squad. We were going to get to it later, but I think we should get to it now.
All right, let's do it.
Suicide Squad is exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
James Gunn is a writer-director. He is a quote-unquote auteur. I'm going to apply that to this. Because he knows exactly what he's doing. He's going R, he's going bold, he's going violent, he's going right to the edge of what's acceptable as these characters who are released from prison by a horrible boss, Viola Davis, government apparatchik extraordinaire. And if they don't do it, it's sort of like Snake Plissken in Escape from New York. If they don't do exactly what they're told, something is going to explode in their neck, and they show you what happens when that happens. So they're supposed to deliver on this mission, and in the process of doing it, led by Idris Elba, who I adore, in the process of doing it, they get, you know, mow down thousands of innocent victims, and somehow James Gunn manages to, you know, twist it around so that you know exactly where the moral lines are drawn, and that the movie is conscious of exactly what it's doing, and each character is used perfectly well. It's very well done.
I mean, he has a very polished kind of approach to the way that he does these Men on a Mission movies, which is why Guardians worked so well. It flows nicely. It's got all these pop music cues. There's certainly a backlash to the persona, and not just because of all the stuff he went through where he was initially fired from Disney for some old tweets or whatever, but also just because there's that.
Well, he got in trouble this week attacking Martin Scorsese.
This was
he hasn't learned his lesson yet.
This was what I was going to get into, was that it's a kind of a film bro-y mentality about things that I think is frustrating, because when you use the A word, there's something auteurish about James Gunn, but it's kind of like auteur in air quotes. It's like, here's me doing that thing again, where I'm going to throw in like a quirky aside with a superhero you didn't think could be funny. And then he's going to use the F-bomb. And then I'm going to throw in a punk rock music cue that you didn't expect to see. So there is something very almost like,
but I would also say that what we learned from the very beginning with the car is that he's incredibly good at setting up frame shots, you know, framing, knowing how to make something look good, knowing how to mount an action sequence. And there's some pretty big, elaborate action sequences in this, and they're beautifully executed. I mean, I get off. This is the sort of thing I get off on, is just appreciating the mise-en-scene. It's just well done.
And unfortunately, it's done better, I think, than the kind of the overall screenplay tropes that it does fall into. I mean, it is an overlong movie that I think gets a little too carried away in its third act, which is true of so many contemporary superhero films. So
but they
much
get permission to do that because it works.
Because it works, because the audience, again, if they're going to pay money to go see this thing, they want a full meal. And so it's a little overdone in that sense, and it lost me towards the end. But I did have a much better time than I would have expected, especially because it's, you know, night and day from the David Ayer one, which is sort of humorless. And I will also say, I think,
and it's better than the one that Kathy Yan did as well. But
enjoyed that movie. I mean, I always feel like it's fascinating when you get to these movies that are, they don't seem like awards contenders, but then you keep coming back to them in certain kinds of ways. And if somebody wanted to try to push for that narrative, I mean, in a weird time for awards, why not push for that? It certainly doesn't seem like
we have a very competitive year, in theory, at least right now. It looks like there's a lot. Of course, we're going to knock some of them out as we see them.
So
that's what the festivals are for. It's a gleaning process.
Did not want to wait for Telluride, unfortunately.
No, it did not.
So speaking of Oscars, so the Academy has elected a whole bunch of new leadership, as you reported this week. It's the most diverse leadership in history. So what exactly does that tell us about the kinds of conversations going forward now that we're not seeing quite as significant a push to increase?
Yeah, the Academy, it's an interesting time for them because, I mean, David Rubin was reelected, although he only has one more year that he can serve before he times out. But they have a lot of challenges ahead of them. And as they try to, this is the year that they're going to have 10 guaranteed best pictures. This is the year, which is good because there's a lot of movies in contention. Yeah. And this is the, you know, they need to go back and make that ABC telecast a successful one. They can't afford to stumble. They need to prove that the Oscars are actually timely and relevant in a way that I don't think we know.
We'll have a fun conversation about that as we get closer. What kind of TV could the Oscars be that wins people back? Because
I know,
I feel like
I don't know that it's even possible. I have no idea. It's sort of like they've managed to keep James Bond relevant all these decades, right? But there's something about the Oscars that are, you know, just anchored in some Billy Crystal past that they can't escape from.
Yeah, the Billy Crystal legacy has become this weird sort of nostalgia that nobody really wants around anymore. But it's funny you mentioned James Bond, because I always think about it as like, you know, there's nothing thrilling about the show as live TV, and you know, being there, it's a great experience, but you don't feel that
it is a great experience to be there.
And I wonder how you can replicate that. I mean, what I loved about the pitch, not the show itself, last year was when Soderbergh said, "What if the Oscars were like a movie?" And I kept thinking, like, "Oh, did they script something that, like, will we watch an actual 90-minute narrative wraparound that ties into the show or something like that?"
He delivered it with the opening sequence, that was about it.
I thought,
you know, which we found out he gave to Regina King a day or two before the actual thing. I mean, but that's a sign of how fly by the seat of the pants this whole thing was.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe if he had given it his full attention, he might have done a better job.
Well, we'll come back to that in the weeks ahead as we figure out.
I think they're not going to make that mistake again.
He's running the Oscars this year. We don't know who's going to do the show yet. So
they went to him to save them from the safety protocols, and he managed to deliver that much.
Yeah. So in other awards news, we should touch briefly on the HFPA rules that came around, which I guess were expected.
They were the ones that everybody, they just had to vote them through. And everybody was kind of saying that they weren't going to do it, and they did it, and they did everything they should have done. The question is whether they're going to be let out of jail now by the I mean, for example, you don't have to live in Southern California. They're going to be looking for new journalists outside of the country, you know, who could come and join them. You know, they can They're actively soliciting people to apply to join and expand, you know, so that they're not going to be, you know, only 90 people. They've expanded their board of directors. They've got a diversity and inclusion officer now that they said they didn't need before. But the point is, are the publicists going to let them out of jail? And it's the publicists who are holding them in jail.
We're saying, are they going to let them into fancy HFPA experiences where they get to hang out with famous people and go to junkets again? Because like, it's not going to be an improvement, right?
So what they're not doing is any kind of Golden Globe show this year. So if we're looking at 23, I guess, would be when they're going to have another one, if they ever do. No, they have not been able to have the press conferences that are their bread and butter. The reason they created this organization in the first place were that these lonely outcasts from around the world, mostly Europe, were not getting good access to celebrities, and so they put themselves into a group and they organized these foreign press conferences. Which have become notorious, and they don't seem to recognize, that's what I find sort of interesting, they don't seem to recognize the degree to which they are the subject of ridicule by all of the publicity people and the stars that participated press conferences. They were not considered respectable journalists by many people.
I would posit to you that maybe some don't recognize it, maybe some do, but like a big pop cultural problem we have is that change doesn't come easily to people who settle into a routine and feel empowered by it, and their automatic instinct is to be defensive and not,
of course.
That defensiveness has been such a terrible Achilles heel, because we live in an era where the natural response to criticism is to, or the appropriate one is to listen, to be willing to change, to be responsive to the need to change. Certainly that's what the industry is trying to do, and fighting back with zero middle ground. I mean, you and I disagree all the time, but we also find common ground. That's the nature of discourse. And they have not entered into this in these terms until now, when basically they have to do it or else they're gone.
They have to do it or they will cease to exist. And the question of whether the publicists are going to let them continue what they used to do is a big question. And the people at the Hollywood Foreign Press feel like they are, and Sasha Stone of all people wrote about this, you know, they're somehow, that it's almost like they're on a blacklist of some kind, that it's equivalent to that, you know, that their livelihood is being taken away by these powerful publicists. What they seem to forget is that it's not being taken away by the powerful publicists alone. It's their clients who don't want to play the game. That's the problem. It's not the publicists, it's the clients. I don't think the HFPA is ready to recognize that at all.
Famous people have the power, at least for now. In any case, so we've been going on a bit, but next week, I think we're going to have more festival news. We've gotten a lot of lineups already, but New York Film Festival's main slate is right around the corner, and we're just revving our engines for the fall, man. So I hope you're enjoying being in one place for now, because one way or another, we're looking at a hectic couple of weeks ahead of us. So I will see you then.
All right. Talk to you later.